Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants of this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. And cast tapes live at 5 p.m. Pacific on Thursdays. Check out my Twitter feed, ANNZAG, for more. Enjoy the show! Welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. A very special guest this week. Now, lately we've been doing a lot of live shows, but we're back with a regular, old-fashioned interview show, and I'm very excited because my guest today is known very well throughout the manga, certainly the manga blogosphere, the manga industry. I would say across cultural barriers in the U.S. and Japan, definitely, like, probably more so in that world, but he is the translator of Shigeru Mizuki's work, Showa, The History of Japan. Currently, he's working on Kitaro. He's also a renowned author. He wrote Yurei, the Japanese Ghost, The Ghost of Oyuki, all this stuff. Can't believe it. Zach Davison, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, great. I'm so happy to finally talk to you after being Twitter pals for, it seems like, a couple of years now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know what? I'm sitting here. I'm like, well, what do I list for his credits? Because it's this long list of incredibly impressive books that I feel like a lot of people own and look at and think, I'm an impressive person because I own these books, right? it's such an impressive collection there, and it's tough to figure out the exact, like, the thing to start with. But the thing that I want to start with is the thing that fascinates me, one of the things that fascinates me most about you is that you started as a normal-ass white guy in a Japanese college classroom, right?
Even before that. I mean, like, really, I started in junior high. I mean,
junior,
you know,
high.
I started studying Japanese in junior, and I'm old enough to where, you know, I mean, this was way before there was any sort of Japan boom or anything. I think there was two students that signed up for the Japanese class, and it eventually got canceled. And this would have been back
really?
In 1986, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And so you were sort of a young weeb early on.
Totally, totally a young weeb. In fact, it just cracks me up because I was back at my mom's house not too long ago, and I found my third grade class picture, and I'm wearing this just like ridiculous cheesy ass t-shirt with like the rising sun on it, and like Nippon written in kanji, and I'm like, God, I was suckered in from a pretty young age.
Wow.
You know, yeah.
Well, you made good on it, I think.
I did, yeah. It's turned out not bad at all. Yeah. It's hard to even say, like, how this all started. You know, it's one of those things where I can pinpoint where it all started, actually. It was when I was really young, my mother talked me into going to see Seven Samurai at this local art theater. And I just went to it, and I was just like, bing. I don't know. I was just absolutely hooked from then on out.
A switch flipped.
Yeah, yeah, there was something. Because the first time I'd ever heard a foreign language being spoken, really, in any sort of length of time, and just sitting in the theater listening to them prattle away in Japanese, I was just completely fascinated.
Right. Well, really, that's it. So it was just an instantaneous, like, me and this culture, that's how it's going to go.
yeah, it was. I mean, and there was a few other things as well. I mean, because it was Seven Samurai that was really the start. And then in, I think it was 1980, I want to say, for reasons that I really don't understand, and I always want to meet the person that made this decision to do it. But do you know the Robin Williams Popeye movie?
I sure do.
Yeah, so they showed that as a double feature with Matsumoto Reiji's Galaxy Express with an English dub version.
That's a weird double feature.
Isn't that just a bizarre double feature? But that was another one of those things where we went as a kid, and my mom, you know, took the whole family, and I just came out of it after seeing Galaxy Express, and I was just like, I was just stunned. I just thought it was one of the most amazing things I had ever seen in my life. And I feel really, actually pretty excited, because recently I've been translating Matsumoto stuff for Kodansha, and so that's been a nice, like, full circle for me, because that definitely planted the seed.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, so you pursued this all throughout your education, then eventually wound up in JET,
and that was the big leaping off point to where, because, like, you know, I just picked up bits and pieces. You know, I'd studied in college and I'd done it, you know, seriously, and then I'd done it less seriously. And I think eventually that was just like, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I've got to, you know, I've got to actually fully commit. And there's no real other way to, I think, to really master Japanese than just to jump into the ocean, you know. And that's where I found Jet and went over there and lived over there for, ended up being about 7 years.
Right. Yeah. So you, so what age did you enter Jet?
I was pretty old at the time, much older than most of the Jets, which still cracks me up. So I was like 30, 31, something like that, I think, okay, when I went on Jet.
All right. And that was in like 2000-ish.
Yeah, that would have been 2001, I think.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'm just curious because that was a period in my life when a lot of my friends were going into Jet. And wound up in similar areas to where you were at. It was a, that's like a lifestyle. That's a, that's an experience, Jet. It's like a thing you can go through. I was curious if you had any sort of observations on Jet as a program then and now. Like, I've actually never had anyone on who went through it that can even speak to it. But what was your experience like there?
Yeah, I mean, I dearly love the Jet program, and I still, it's funny because I still speak with the Jet coordinator nowadays. We've actually become good friends. I'm like, you know, you just didn't know what you were getting yourself into when you sent me on that plane, you know,
right,
years ago. And I think Jet, you know, like a lot of people will say to me, oh, you're so lucky to have done this. And I'm like, really, really, luck had absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, right. Jet opened this door and they provide an opportunity. And, you know, it's a hard application process that you got to work your way through. And when you get over there, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there and you still have to take advantage of it. You know, you have all, I've known people that have gone over on Jet and, like, you know, they basically, you know, drank and partied for a year and came home and it was nothing. You know, they had absolutely no effect on them, you know.
Right.
And you can do that with Jet. You can go there and you can hang out and you can come back and you can never, you know, nothing changes about you whatsoever. Or you can decide, like I did, to seriously commit to getting the most out of the opportunity. And like, I got my master's degree when I was on Jet. And there's a lot of opportunity there, but you have to take it. No one's going to handhold you through the process. They're just like, yo, here's what's on the table. Here's the buffet. And you can eat all the junk food and have a great time and go home. Or you can like seriously decide to do something with it.
So you would still recommend Jet now for people who, you know, want to go through something like that, who want that experience?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's still the choice. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. Jet is, to me, and I tell people that all the time. You know, people are like, oh, I want to do it. Well, then do it. You know, go on Jet. But be prepared for, you know, like I was talking one, every now and then I'll meet people where I'm like, I actually don't recommend Jet for you. Because when you go over on Jet, you're super isolated, you know, just completely and utterly isolated in a way that most people have never experienced before, especially if you're a white person, because you've never had to deal with the ostracization that comes with entrenched racism. That is something that is part and parcel of Japan, you know, right. And you go over there and, you know, you'll have, you know, nobody treats you as a person. They treat you as a sort of, you know, a commodity or an oddity, for lack of a better word. You know, you walk through the streets and people look at you, you go to the shopping, and that's just part of the experience. And if you don't have the sort of psyche to be able to withstand that, then I mean, people commit suicide on Jet every single year. It's not something they advertise, obviously, but it happens. You know, I knew at least 3 people that died when I was over there.
Okay, I've never heard that. That is stunning. But I guess unfortunately not surprising. It's stunning, but it's not surprising.
It's not surprising, right? I mean, it's just, you know, you're dealing with a large number of people. And there's some people who feel like the people that have the worst time on Jet and the people that have the worst time in Japan in general are the people that have a really hardcore fantasy image of what Japan's actually like. And I try my best to shatter that image, both in when I talk to people about what Japan is like, you know, whether it's on Twitter or whatever, that, you know, Japan is not this paradise of anime and manga. You know, it's not like you get over there and you'll be embraced. It's not like going to a country-sized con. I mean, not at all.
Yeah, right. It's not a theme park version of
No.
Yeah.
No, it's not, you know. It's a real place and it's a real world, and, you know, a large number of people there, they couldn't care less about manga or anime or anything like that, you know. It is what it is.
My friends who went through Jet and people that I know who've gone through it, I wonder if you would agree with this statement that they tend to say that, like, they're cool with you if you're just a tourist and you embrace that and you leave eventually. But totally. if you show up and you make designs on, oh, I'm going to stay here and live with you, that's when they want you maybe out.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. I would say that they're way more cool with it. If you are a tourist and you go over there and you're like, wow, like yeah. nothing would make Japanese people more pleased
yeah.
than for you to show up and act like, you know, the crazy foreigner.
I do that.
They always want, you know, to go up there and like, oh, yeah. sushi, oh, chopsticks, I can't use them. I mean, yeah. they've got TV shows in Japan that are nothing more than importing foreigners and putting them on the spot in like a Japanese, you know, like kaiseki restaurant, watch them make a fool out of themselves attempting to eat all this stuff. I mean, that's great entertainment for Japan.
Yeah. I mean, I would just say like, I don't like go full for it, but I absolutely embrace the, oh, I'm a dumb white tourist. You guys tell my idiot ass what to do. Like, and they love it. They're more than happy. Like, oh, you're stupid. Here you go. Like, I love it.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, once you're over there and you're like, you know, like, no, I don't want to play the fool. I want to, you know, I intend to be serious about you. Yeah. There's definitely some resistance there. You're not as welcome, you know?
Right. Yeah, totally. That's fascinating. So back to your career, you sort of immediately gravitated towards, really high profile prestige stuff. I mean, Shigeru Mizuki is like you have characterized him. He's basically a living Buddha in Japan, right? And you were immediately gravitating towards this guy's stuff.
Well, he was always my, like, I don't know, I've told this story and it's an absolutely true story. But when I got to Japan, I was just, when I saw Mizuki, I mean, there was just this weird moment, just like Seven Samurai when I was a kid. And I've had a few times where I just saw someone and I'm like, oh, I've met my destiny here. You know, I ran into his stuff in this, this store called Kitty Land, which is at the bottom of a train station in Osaka. And I had never heard of the guy whatsoever, you know, never knew any of these characters. And I was just completely fascinated by them. I thought they were the coolest things I'd ever seen. And I couldn't believe that as someone that considered himself fairly Japan savvy, that there was this huge part of the culture that I was completely blind to that I just never even heard of. And the more I dove into it, you know, the more I mastered the language, the more I really got deeply into researching about Mizuki and everything. And he seemed like such a fascinating and important genius and so integral to the culture of the country that I just couldn't believe that he'd never been translated into English before. So one night at one of my friend's bars, I actually, you know, like climbed up on the table and made this drunken vow that I would make it my holy mission to bring Mizuki to the West, you know, that I would be his apostle. And when I got back to Japan, when I got back to the States, I started up on that. I just was like knocking on publishers' doors everywhere. I'm like, you know, you got to let me do this. You got to let me bring Mizuki over. And it was just, you know, no, until finally Drawn and Quarterly had the license. And that was completely independent. They got the license without me even knowing about it. So I just went onto their website and found their little contact me button and sent them like this big email and like, you know, hello, I'm your new translator for your series, and just basically introduced myself. And that's how I got started.
Right, which is really impressive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was like I never really set out to be a manga translator. And I was in general, like, and I was talking to some of my Kodansha editors about that. There's like, you know, I have a very specific goal in mind with what I like to translate. And so people that I connect with, you know, they know to bring me projects that are specific to me.
Right.
He's like, you know, I'm not going to send you the latest shoujo rom-com because you have this sort of, I don't know, I'm not sure the right word for it, this thing that you're trying to accomplish as a translator. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So
right, yeah, well, it's a good place to be. And like, I feel like, so the world that you're in, it's weird because it exists between two places, which is I would hypothesize that that's probably why nobody really wanted to take a chance on it in the early going, is because this is stuff that looks like it's too childish for, because it's comics, that means it's too childish and not taken seriously by academic hoi polloi. And it's too weird looking and old for manga fans. So it's in the middle of this thing where it's like, well, who's the market for this? That where a publisher's actually going to take a chance?
It is. And as I found out, another barrier, and I didn't know this at the time, is that Mizuki himself. Like, Mizuki was really, he had a lot of control over his work and how it was presented. And he felt that several companies had come to an attempt to, as he put it, to just cherry pick his sellable stuff, but ignore his serious work, you know. And so he was looking for a company that was willing to represent him as a complete artist. Right. And that meant stuff like Hitler as well as stuff like Kitaro.
Right, which, you know, weirdly, I feel like in today's market, I mean, that Hitler stuff is going to sell way better. Like, I would imagine Showa has probably done very well, or at least done met expectations. Something like that is generally going to do pretty better than, you know, if they're trying to repackage this stuff for kids or whatever. Like,
totally. Yeah. And Showa, I mean, you know, when they first started, when Drawn and Quarterly first started out, you know, I mean, like they gave me their list, like, you know, here we're doing Showa and we're doing this. And I'm like, wow, that is not what I would have picked as the way to go. But I think it was a really savvy move because, like you said, it's much easier to market World War II comic written by World War II veteran, you know?
Yeah, right.
you don't care at that point if the manga people are going to read it because you're marketing to the same people that read Mouse, which is a much wider audience than the people that are into, you know, Natsume's Book of Friends or things like that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you're going to struggle with the people who want Natsume's Book of Friends because they're looking for escapism, and that's not what you're selling at all.
No.
So, you know, it's fascinating. As you have navigated the manga world, it sounds like you've managed to avoid getting stuck, you know, not that that would be getting stuck there, but you're not stuck translating stuff you don't want to work on.
No, if I translate a project 100% of the time, it's because something I'm passionate about. I mean, absolutely.
Which is totally a position of privilege.
It is.
Must be. There were probably translators listening to this like, oh, must be nice.
Had many translators come up to me and you know, it's like, how did you do that? And I'm like, honestly, I don't know. I don't know how I did it. I really don't have a roadmap laid out for anyone. All I can say is that, you know, I got the opportunity from you know, Drawn and Quarterly, and that I think I've proved myself as being I've proved my abilities with the work I've done with them, and that obviously attracts editors from other companies that get to bring me stuff.
Right, exactly. So, what do you think? Like, in terms of let's talk a little bit about Showa first.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about this? Is particularly like the special quality of it, because World War II history is saturated in the U.S., but this thing it's pretty impressive. And I was wondering, being the person perhaps the most intimately familiar with the work aside from the artist himself, what do you think the special quality is? Like, if you could sum it up, like, here's why you should read this. How would you?
Yeah, God, that's a really tough question to answer. Like, I mean, the special quality, obviously, is Mizuki himself. You know, I mean, it's that he has a particular genius that's comparable to, you know, he's a Walt Disney. You know, he's one of those people that just has this unique, I don't know, this unique art about him that no matter what he does, you know, his touch is very much in there. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the fact that it's his autobiography, the fact that all of this is going on, the fact that he uses his own characters, you know, I mean, when I talk to people about Showa, it's like I say, imagine if Walt Disney had fought in the Vietnam War and decided to write, you know, my diaries using Donald Duck as the narrator. You know, it's just so completely strange. But at the same time, it's a very honest memoir, you know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a totally unique perspective, something we, especially in the U.S., really don't get the chance to read a lot. Like, there's not a lot of material like this published over here for our edification. It's
And even more so from the point of view of the opposite side, because I realized when I was doing Showa, I really challenged a lot of my long cherished beliefs, because I realized that I knew World War II from essentially the victor's narrative, you know? And I had believed a lot of things that when I was doing the book, I had to realize that that wasn't necessarily true. I mean, I'm of the generation where my family was involved in World War II. In fact, one of the things that I did when I was translating it, just to bring a little bit of verisimilitude to the translation, was I took my grandfather as World War II, because he was stationed in Hawaii and was actually at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. So I took his Japanese English dictionary that had been issued to all of them and used that to help look up some of the military terms.
Yeesh. Well, gosh.
But I mean, I think that when you do translation, like if you really want to do a good translation, you have to bring that level of emotion to it. You know, I mean, we're not technicians just swapping one word out for the other. You have to really deeply get involved in it for it to be an effective translation. And so I always try to do that. I try and find that sort of like personal emotional hook into things when I'm working on it.
You know, that is the thing about you that I really personally responded to when I was reading some interviews with you and about you previously, is that you do seem to have a dogma about translating, and you've written about it. You wrote this big piece, great piece, on the Comics Journal called Confessions of a Manga Translator that everyone listening to this should read that piece. It's really good. You're arguing that translation is absolutely not a machine technology. It is not a machine process. It is a artistic process that is largely emotional, that I really responded to. I thought that was incredibly insightful, and it seems like you're making an argument, and there is an attitude out there that you are actively arguing against, which is that translation is basically something that can be done by a computer.
No, absolutely cannot.
So do you see that out there? There's sort of an opposing force, like you're making that argument, hey, this is a human thing. And yeah. do you see it that way?
I do. I mean, translation is absolutely, I mean, the day that translation can be done effectively by a computer is the day that writing will be effectively done by a computer. You know, when computers can write books and write comics and draw comics without a human hand is the same time that you'll be able to do that with translation. I mean, translation is very, very, very much a creative endeavor. I mean, I just read an article yesterday where they were comparing to Tolstoy translators and how some people felt very much, you know, we're on the side of one or the other of two, because two translators would produce an entirely different book. You know, I mean, there's no way not to have your own voice in there. It's one of those things, like when I heard Jay Rubin talk about this, it was really enlightening as well. And a lot of the ideas in that article come from Jay Rubin, who's Murakami's Haruki's translator, where he's like, you know, I mean, he's essentially a collaboration between the translator and the artist.
Right. Right. Which is that's a really different process from what these people, what the other argument basically is, which is like they're sort of arguing in favor of these really technical translations that don't have to be flowing proper, like readable English. It's just here's a vague hint at what they're kind of saying. And yeah, there's going to be a bunch of untranslated words in there. So basically, it's not crossing the cultural boundary at all. It's just giving you sort of a kind of a vague idea.
Yeah, which kills me. And I think, honestly, it would kill the original author as well. Because when they create something, I mean, like they're writing this stuff in order to get to evoke an emotional response from someone. I mean, when you're reading it, that's kind of the part, right? You know, you're supposed to get involved in the story. You're supposed to feel the character's emotions, or you're supposed to, you know, get excited or sad or something like that. I mean, all writing is intended to invoke some sort of emotional response. And if you're reading bad translation, if you're reading stuff with untranslated words, you know, if you're flipping to the back for translator's notes and blah, 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 all this other stuff that happens, then you're not getting as emotionally involved in the book and the story and the characters.
Right, exactly. And I think just speaking about that from a translator's perspective, like I'm going to feel these things while I'm writing this. I feel like that's a really important thing to reveal about that job. And yeah. I feel like it's funny because the argument against it is vague, but you can hear it in the back of your head. You can hear it in the back of your head while you're saying, "Oh, this is a subjective, personal, creative thing that I'm mm-hmm. doing." It absolutely is. You're just going to have to deal with it. You can hear the argument in your back of your head. Well, it shouldn't be, and it's like, but it is, and it's always going to be. So this desire for machine translation, I feel like. Hopefully it won't get to the point where people like your jobs are endangered to the point where they'll get far enough and say like, oh wait, this doesn't really work. Oh, we can't really use machines.
Yeah.
For all
I mean,
this
I know
stuff.
Like the publishers would love to do that because it would save them the expense of a translator. And you know, I mean, obviously maybe someday it'll get there. I don't know. Everything, it depends on the language. I mean, Japanese and English are so completely different from each other that machine translation is just a joke at this stage.
Right.
But, you know, to those people that are, if you're really concerned about, if you're really concerned about reading the original, then learn Japanese.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. You know, like if that is really important to you, if you really want to know, then there is no substitute. Any translation is always going to interpose a barrier between the original and what you're reading. I mean, that is just part of the deal.
Right, right, exactly. all right, so the next thing, the you've got Showa out there, and Drone Quarterly is putting out Kitaro, known to old-timers like me as Gegege no Kitaro. My exposure to Gigagino Katara was one 30-minute movie that was fan-subbed in the 90s and spread around. Like, there was one thing that spread around on VHS.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, yeah. That was the only thing that ever spread around. It's the only thing anyone had ever seen. Like, any of the fans I knew, like, that was their exposure to Gigagino Katara. Like, sometimes you'd see the comics translated in weird places. Like, there would be, like, one page or something translated, and people would use the little eyeball guy. They would steal that for, like, punk flyers and things like that.
Yeah, and they did the Kodansha bilingual editions,
yes,
which
that
were,
was the one.
Were
yeah.
terrible.
Were they? Okay.
I shouldn't say they were terrible. They're, you know, and that goes into, like, different translation styles where, the, to me, there's, like, a translation too far. And that one, like, you know, they went through and renamed all the new characters. Like, you know, Nurikabi was Wally Wall. And, you know, just it was a little bit too much Americanized for my taste.
Right. And so, and yeah. And so this property was a challenge to bring over here, and nobody really knew how to sell it. So tell us about Katara. Like, what is this collection? What should people look for if they're going to check this thing out?
So this is like, I mean, this collection of Katara is really, I am just exceedingly proud of it, you know, because, you know, I've worked with Drawn in Quarterly for a couple of years, and, you know, things have been really successful. And I think we've really developed a good trust with each other that they, you know, I mean, because this version here, it's all my personally curated stories that I created. And so basically the thing that we had done with Mizuki is that they put out the test volume of, I don't know, I shouldn't call it the test volume, but they put out the previous volume of Kitaro, which is great. You know, it's the big one. It's the same size as Showa and everything else. And we wanted to do more of it. And so Mizuki is kind of funny, but he sort of like issued this challenge to Drawn in Quarterly where he's like, you know, I'm not really sure, you know, you guys have been doing a really good job so far, but I'm not really sure if everything's as much as I wanted to. But anyways, he issued this challenge saying, you know, give me a list of 50 of your stories, of my stories that you want to translate. And from the list that you'll give me, I'll know if you know my works enough to continue our relationship. I mean, so like, whoa. No pressure there. Yeah. Drawn in Quarterly passed that ball to me and they're like, hey, could you put together this list real quick?
Yeah, they're lucky they had you. Like.
Yeah, they are. Because I put together my list and I passed it over to Mizuki and he looked it over and he accepted 49 of the 50. He crossed one of them off saying, well, you can have the rest, but this one's just crap. So I think he was kind of being imperious there just because he couldn't accept the list as is. But
yeah, of course not.
Yeah, we got that, and so from that, they gave us the go-ahead to do this new Kitaro series.
And this collection, this is curated, this is sort of a best of...
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's funny with Kitaro is that, I mean, it goes, like, there's no rhyme or reason to the series, there's no continuity, there's no storyline, you know, some people said, why don't you go in order? And I'm like, well, mainly because there's no reason to go in order, the stories themselves don't go into order. I mean, he was writing them at the time when they were considered to be very disposable, you know, he'd script one off and send it in and reprint it in a weekly magazine, and the next time a reader, you know, may pick one up, may not pick it up, but there's no actual storyline, so... You know, I grouped a few of the stories, like after I got my group of stories I really liked and I thought were great. And there was a few that I definitely wanted to put in the first volume. Like I'd heard a lot of people have said like, oh, you know, there was no Neko Musume story. So I'm like, okay, I got to make sure I get that in the first volume, even though she actually doesn't appear very much in the comic. She's much more of an anime character than she actually is in the comic itself. But, you know, I wanted to put a few hits in the first one.
Right.
And also just page count. You know, we had a page count, so we had to vary that out between longer stories and shorter stories.
Right, yeah. It kind of reminds me of what Fantagraphics is doing with Karl Barks and Don Rosa, the Duck comics. It's similar in that those are also out of order, but it's kind of a best of, here's the finest material, you know. With shorter and longer stories, yeah, just like that. So, in your opinion, what's the coolest stuff? Like, this is going to be a long series. People who really want to, you know, check this out, where should they? I mean, obviously, this is such a weird question to ask because it's like, well, start at the beginning, but there's like seven or eight like curated volumes of different types of stories. So I'm just curious what the coolest one is.
Well, I mean, like, I think, you know, Birth of Kitaro, the first volume, is the one that I think. is like I packed a lot of the cool, like really cool stuff in there because like, well, basically what I tried to do was I tried to give every volume an anchor story, right. You know, something that was really kind of famous. So like in the second story, we have Kitaro meets Nodarihon, which is, you know, a famous story. And then the third one is actually almost an entirely book length version. So the third one is a really, really long one. And that's the Great Tanuki War. And then there's a few, I think, that I didn't have an anchor story for. And so they're just kind of cool mishmash collections. And they're the ones that have, I made up all the titles for them too. Like I called them like Kitaro's Yokai Battles and Kitaro's Strange Adventures and
right,
stuff like
yeah.
that. But you know, I mean, they're all so much fun. And that's why I'm really happy to do the smaller versions of them too, because I feel like we've had a couple years of serious Mizuki, and I feel that he's been put on such a pedestal nowadays, and especially with his passing, you know, like everyone is in a great hurry to honor him, which I think is right. awesome, and I think he should be honored, but I think at the same time he should be enjoyed. So that's kind of like what these smaller volumes are. It's like, hey, this is, you know, Mizuki that it doesn't have to be a prestige shelf thing. This is throw in a backpack, you know, walk around, read, and just have a good time with. And that's mostly what the stories are. You know, they're just super duper fun.
Right. Yeah. That's important. Cause I feel like it's easy to pitch, especially with someone like this, it would be really easy to establish their identity in the American marketplace as only a prestige author. And
exactly.
So you are only going to read this if you're in academia and you're in your 40s and blah, 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 you know? So, it's good. It's good to establish that stuff.
And, you know, it's funny because with Kitaro, like one of Mizuki himself is that like he's beloved by comic book authors. You know, it's so like comic book artists as well. I think far more than the manga crowd. Like I did Emerald City Comic Con recently and like, you know, Brandon Graham's coming up to me and like, you know, a lot of people that are really big into American comics and a lot of prestige artists, they love Mizuki. I think more than manga people do.
The thing that I wanted to get to before we get to these Twitter questions mm-hmm. was two things. One, you translated the art of Satoshi Kon.
I did, yeah.
For Dark Horse.
Yeah.
What was
yeah,
working?
I traded all of Dark Horse's Satoshi Kon stuff. And that's actually really interesting. So I you know, if anyone wants to know, like for my Confessions of a Translator manga, like with Mizuki, I've translated all of his stuff. Well, not all of it, because there was a few volumes done before I got there, but most of his stuff. But Satoshi Kon, you can look at the stuff Vertical did, and you can look at the stuff that I did for Dark Horse and see how a translator affects, you know, same artist, different translator, and you can see the differences there.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So what do you feel you learned about Satoshi Kon during your time translating his stuff? Because this guy is at this point so legend.
I mean, I love Satoshi Kon. I mean, I've always loved Satoshi Kon, as all right-thinking people do.
Right.
One of the things that I found so fascinating about Satoshi Kon, because like the same thing, like when I translate someone's work, I have to, and it's not that hard to get emotionally into Kon because I've been, you know, in love with his works for so long, but I went on online and, you know, read his blog extensively because he actually, he wrote quite a lot in his blog and it was really fascinating to get in there and just sort of read his personal thoughts when I was working on his stuff. But I thought it was amazing how he seemed to have always been Satoshi Kon. I mean, there was, you know, he was like born with this perfectly realized vision, and even like, you know, you see his early works like Opus and it fits perfectly into his later stuff. You know, he had this vision of what he wanted to do and he never deviated from that during his entire career. It's just amazing.
Did you get any sense of his personality, like what kind of man he was? Did you get any sense like do you think he took himself really seriously? Do you think he did he prefer to laugh or did he prefer to cry? Like, well, I feel you like know, those are kind of the things you might get to know.
He you know, especially from diving into his blog, he seemed like he was kind of, you know, I don't know, like, what's the right word for it? He seemed like he laughed at things more than you know, and especially with American movies ripping off his stuff, he had quite a bit to say about that, you know.
Oh wow, okay.
Where he would be like, oh god, he had this one blog interview where he's like, you know, it's like, oh, I heard that this is an homage to me. I'm like, I guess I misunderstood English, that homage is another word for theft, you know, and just like all this other stuff. So, and like his success, he never had great success in Japan as well. I mean, success constantly eluded him, especially financial success, and he's not very well known in Japan.
Right.
it was a perfect example of that. That when Dark Horse contacted me, and Carl Horn actually gave me the job, and I was so excited that I came home, and my wife was having a party with a bunch of her friends who are all Japanese, and I was like, oh, I just got hired from Dark Horse. I get to do their Satoshi Kon line. And they all looked at me, and they're like, who? I mean, never heard of him.
Absolutely. Wow.
No idea who he is.
Yeah.
He's far, far more famous in the West, which actually, I mean, Kurosawa Akira is the same way. You know, he's far, far more famous in the West than he actually is in Japan itself.
If you think about it, though, if you look at Kon's stuff, it's, again, it's not that surprising.
No,
like,
it's not.
His illustrative style alone is fairly, I could definitely see it appealing way more here. Like, Perfect Blue was, you know, definitely going to please Western audiences, you know?
You know, it's so, I mean, yeah, it's definitely more Western appealing than it is for Japan. And you can easily see how directors over here were just like, oh, yeah, you know, we can just take this and we can just make an entire genre here that's basically, you know, Kon-esque stuff, but we don't actually have to name it that.
Yeah, well, that's
sad. It's really sad.
Well, yeah, it is. That's every time I think about it, because he was still at the beginning of his career.
Mm-hmm.
He had barely gotten started.
I was going to say, it's the same, like, he had the same wall that Kurosawa did, which towards the end of his career, you know, I mean, which shouldn't have been the end of his career, of course, because he died, but he couldn't get money to finance his films in Japan.
Yeah. That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the only reason Kurosawa kept making movies is because American directors were paying for them. But no one in Japan actually liked them enough to pay for them.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, though. I bet if he were still alive,
I bet
he'd be making movies for Americans.
I bet the studios over here would be like, sure, we'll find
another.
All right.
The directors that are ripping him off would eventually just hire him.
One would hope.
Yeah, you would hope.
Although, God, I can't remember which director it was, but there was somewhere, it was just like, it was so insulting, because like, he gave him an interview, he was like, oh, Kon? No, never even heard the name. And it, like, he did like screen for screen ripoffs of Perfect Blue, and it was just like, oh, you got to be kidding. What a ass maneuver.
Right. Yeah, totally. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to ask you about, before we get to the Twitter questions, was when I was in Japan last time, no, it was like 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. It wasn't the last time. I was in, geez, where was I? It's Shinjuku. I had gotten off the Yamanote at Shinjuku, and I was going all the way to the very top of that government building with all the homeless population camped around behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I was going up there specifically to see, because if you look down, you can see the homeless. And I was like, I, you know, this is Tokyo. I want to see there, you know. But anyway, on the way there, there was a museum in what was a gigantic tunnel through the train station there, with a bunch of Mizuki's illustrations on the sign. And I was not able to figure out what exact part of World War II this museum was showing me. But there were a lot of physical displays of soldiers coming home from a war or leaving war. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's a bunch of Mizuki illustrations all over the sign in all of their promotional material. So he apparently he illustrated this at some point.
So I think I do know. So when was this?
This was in 2009, I want to say.
Okay.
2010, maybe.
Bet what it was. I know at one point they did a because like his stuff, you know, they do, like, they're doing one right now in Sunshine City in Tokyo, and like, you know, his stuff does a lot of these traveling exhibits. But I know at one point in time, and it probably would have been out then, they did an entire work on basically, you know, Mizuki's war diaries is what they called it, and that was up in a museum exhibition as well, and it was all of his paintings and information combined with real life documents and everything from this battle in the South Pacific on the island of Rabaul.
Right.
So I'm guessing that that's what it was.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
They were pretty awesome. Like, 'cause I've seen pictures of it. If it's what you're talking about, like, they blew some of his artwork up really big, and, you know, did they do stuff like that?
It was like that, and they had animatronics. Yeah. Like,
oh, no way.
Yeah,
oh,
there were cool displays of, they had recreated scenes and stuff like that. So it looked pretty old. So I wasn't sure I'm not sure if it was traveling or anything like that. But it, I don't know, man. It was interesting.
I was so sad when I hear about this stuff, because I miss out on so much. Like, just a few years back, they did They did Mizuki's Yokai Gakuen, Yokai Paradise, Gokuraku in Osaka, and I was like, oh, why didn't they do that when I lived there?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Although I did get to meet Mizuki at the World Yokai Conference when I lived there, so, you know.
Well, then there's that.
Yeah, so that's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, all right, let's get to these Twitter questions. We got plenty of them. Sure. All right, Nighttime App asks, what's your favorite story, any medium?
My favorite story, any medium. God, I saw that question go up on Twitter. I'm like, how do you answer that? I honestly don't know.
Most people don't have one, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, I mean, I have millions of favorite stories. I can't pick like a single favorite story, you know? I mean, there's so much that I love. Like, you know, it just ended, and so it's completely on my brain, and that's a lot of how these things work. But I would have to say that Mike Mignola's Hellboy series is probably one of the most amazing comic books I've ever read in my entire life, and deeply impactful on me.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Like his folklore work and everything got me seriously involved in pursuing folklore at a young age. Not a young age, I guess. But back when it first came out, you know, like just all of his use of world folklore, and something that I really loved in Mizuki's work as well. And I often compare Mizuki and Mignola as being similar artists. You know, when people talk about the divide between like, you know, this is manga, this is American comics, I'm like, I think Mizuki and Mignola work in the same genre. I don't really see them as being Japanese Western divide. You know, they're both folklorists. So, I'm going to throw Hellboy out as my answer.
Okay. And, the second part of that question is, what book, story, anime, or manga changed the way you look at the medium?
Look, I just got to answer it again.
There you go. All right.
Yeah, definitely. Like, Hellboy I am firmly convinced that, and I think I have a good grasp on this because I read a lot of stuff, you know, I read a lot of stuff from the 1800s, and I have a good sense of what lasts the test of time. And I'm pretty sure that 100 years from now, what they're still going to be studying in university is going to be Hellboy. When the rest of the ephemera has sort of faded away, I think that one's still going to be around.
You think so?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. All right, Joel Dreyer asks, both Mizuki and Tatsumi wrote notable biography manga about the Showa era. Who would you like to see do a modern one?
Yeah, that's tough because, you know, I mean, autobiography, like, you know, at the time in the Gekiga era, that was a real big thing. And although Mizuki always put himself into his work so early, even back from the rental stories, you know, like when you see The Birth of Kitaro, that, you know, the really, really old stuff, he was naming his characters after himself, which I don't know if there's any modern artists that are really doing that. I mean, there's modern artists whose work I really like, and I think I would enjoy seeing their autobiography, but
Kubo, yeah. Tite, that's your answer.
Oh, is that my answer? Okay.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know anyone. I mean, I think that autobiographical manga is really, there's no one that, like, you have to have the sort of desire to do it. Like, I can't remember the name of him, but he did this comic called Disappearance Diary. Right. That was an autobiographical manga about his time as a homeless person in Japan. And I knew nothing about him, but that is just a fascinating, fascinating comic.
Yeah.
So my answer would be whoever would do a good job at it.
All right.
And has the passion for it.
All right. Friend of the show, Ed Sizemore asks, what's it like to translate older manga? Is language an issue? And does translating the same author get easier over time?
Definitely translating the same author gets easier over time. One of the hardest things when I tackle a new author is trying to find their voice. You know, like with Mizuki, I completely can live in Mizuki's head, no problem. I feel like we're absolutely in sync. And so when I tackle a new one of his projects, it's really just like, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like Game of Thrones, you know, and being a, you know, slipping into someone else's skin if you're a skinwalker there, you know, it's like I put on my Mizuki costume and I get right immediately into his head. But then when I had to do Matsumoto Reiji, I felt that when I first started working on it, his work was sounding too much like Mizuki. And just because I had to sort of find him in order to do his work properly. And I managed to do that actually by playing Wagner in the background, and I was playing, you know, like just all of this really heavy classical work, and I felt that helped me sort of get into his head. And like the new one I'm doing, The Ghost and the Lady now, you know, once again, like the last 100 pages are so much easier than that just sort of struggle to find this person's voice. And once I've got it, I've got it. And then if I get to keep with that person and keep doing that same author, it's great because I've already got their voice down. As far as doing the older stuff, I mean, definitely there's a different sensibility of language that happens. And I try my best to keep that. Like, I don't want to modernize things too much. But, I mean, there'll be certain, like, old slang and things like that that I'll just sort of disregard because I think it dates the book. But for the most part, like, people like Matsumoto and Mizuki, like, they really wrote these classic works that stand the test of time on their own.
Also from Ed Sizemore, are yokai an extension of Shintoism?
Yes, they are. I mean, they are Shinto in a way. If you look at really old Shinto, I mean, like the really old concept of Shinto, when you get back into its early foundations, pre-contact with Buddhism, was this concept of a spiritual world, you know, and yokai have always been very much involved in that. In fact, there's an old word for yokai where basically they are considered to be unworshipped gods, with the only difference between Shinto deities or kami is that they're actually worshipped, and if no one's worshipping this deity, then they become yokai.
Right.
So they are very, very deeply involved with each other. Ed's another guy that I've been in contact with forever and would love to meet someday, by the way.
Well, you make his day by showing up to a convention that he's at.
I would love that. But with conventions, you know, it's always the funny thing is they've got to invite me over. So it's never my choice what conventions I go to, unfortunately.
Yeah. Ed has another question. Have they documented all yokai, or are they still finding new stories?
You know, they're all like yokai is one of the other words for yokai that a lot of people are also familiar with because it has different terminology is bakemono, which means changing things. And that is so core and inherent to the nature of yokai is that they're in a fluid state. They're constantly changing. So you can never get all of them. Like, I'm sure there's lots that have been lost to time and people are still constantly creating new yokai. It's an evolving process that should never change because yokai, I mean, they only have meaning as like any folklore. It has to change and adapt to meet modern sensibilities. It's not meant to be kept under glass or, you know, bound for just study purposes. In order for that to live, it has to constantly evolve. And so yokai also constantly evolve.
Okay. Land of Obscusion asks, with Mizuki and Matsumoto being given new chances here, are there any other iconic creators that you feel should have second chances?
Yeah, you know, it's weird for me to think of them as being second chances, but I guess that's kind of what it is. I mean, I wish all of the classic manga guys had, like, I wish you could get more of some of the classic stuff. Like Matsumoto, like, I would dearly love to do Space Battleship Yamato. That's like, you know, I've got this little hope shelf at home of work that I would love to translate and hopefully we'll get to someday. Then there's a lot of really oddballs. Like, I really like this artist named Miyuki Saga, who I think has absolutely no chance of getting an American translation just because she's way too old-fashioned. But she did all this shoujo horror stuff in the 60s, which is really 60s, like the fashion and everything, you know. I mean, it's kind of crazy odd stuff, but I really like it. So right. I always throw her name out there in the hopes that someday, but she's just, you know, it's a super duper long shot, you know. But definitely more of, like, even more Matsumoto stuff, you know more, like, I would love more Junji Ito. I mean, I'd love more of all of those guys.
Yeah, Junji Ito. I mean, I'm a little surprised there's not more of his stuff.
Right? I know. His stuff's amazing. And all we ever get is, like, just the merest little pinprick of the output that he's done. But, you know, I completely understand that because, you know, as a publisher, you have to publish the stuff that sells, you know, and that's just the reality of it.
Right, exactly. Okay, so we got a bunch more from Ed, but I'm gonna give these to you. You can answer them rapid fire if you can.
Okay, I'll rapid fire.
Okay. Have you been to Mizuki's hometown?
You know, to my great embarrassment, I have never been to Sakai Minato.
All right, then. And what work of his is your favorite?
My favorite would definitely be Tono Monogatari, which is something that I'm trying to get on the publication list, but it's a really, really wonderful book of his from the old Japanese, one of the original classic works of the Yokai text that he did an adaptation of.
Right. So that answers the next question. Is there a Mizuki work you really, really want to see translated?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Tono Monogatari, Tales of Tono.
Any other classic manga you'd like to translate?
Oh, I really want to do Space Battleship Yamato. Right. Unfortunately, with Matsumoto, his rights are held by random people. So that's been a real challenge with some of these older people like Mizuki. Fortunately, Mizuki Pro owns the rights to everything. So when you get one, you can get them all. But a lot of these older people, it's harder to get the rights to.
Yeah, chasing those rights down is usually the biggest speed bump.
Yeah.
From what, the way people talk. Let's see. What are your favorite sources for yokai stories?
My favorite stories, I mean, I love the old Edo period. Like, they used to make these kaidan shoes, what they were called, and they were just basically, you know, like, they pumped them out by the tons, you know, just like comics are now. And I love the old kaidan shoe. I've got quite a few collections of those, actually.
Cool. All right. And finally from Ed, what was the reaction to your article on how much the translator's voice is what the readers read? We were talking about this earlier.
Wow, it's hard to rapid fire out that one.
You can slow down for that one.
Yeah, I mean the response to that article was pretty stunning, you know, because I actually wrote that article back in December, and I just put out a bunch of stuff December of last year, and I just basically had a bunch of ideas, you know, things that I've been thinking about translation for a while, and I fully expected that Comics Journal would publish that and that it would disappear, nobody would care. And it was only pure luxury of timing and zeitgeist that it came out 3 months later, right when that Nintendo Fate Emblem translation thing was going on. So I think that if it hadn't hit exactly then, and a lot of people actually thought I wrote it in response to that, but no, I'd actually written it 3 months earlier. It just takes time for stuff to get on the publication schedule. Right. But yeah, it was great. It was overwhelming. The best and my favorite part of it was hearing from all of my fellow translators. And I mean, not even Japanese translators, you know, like Czech translators and Russian translators, and so many people just writing to me saying like, wow, you know, you finally put into words something that I've always felt. And I feel like translators are this real sort of, you know, hidden voice. And a lot of people don't want to know about translators. A lot of people feel like we're some sort of, you know, barrier in between them and making this connection with the original artist. And I suppose we are in a way, but it's also the reality of the business is that, you know, we're here. So, yeah, it was good. It was really good. I got a lot of really positive responses. It was funny because it's by far the most popular thing I've ever written that was posted on the internet. So I got to snoop on Twitter and watch people talk about me, and they'd be like, what Davison is saying here is blah blah blah, and it was pretty
yeah.
Never had that happen before.
Yeah, it's got its highs and its lows.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it thrust me into a whole different arena, which was good, you know, and I hopefully got a little more profile for the role of the translator, which is what I really wanted. You know, it's so funny because like you go to these comic conventions or anime conventions and people are like flipping out over the voice actors and things like that, but you don't get a lot of love for the translators. I'm like, why so much love for one person who's putting a voice to a character that you love but not another person who's essentially doing the exact same thing, although possibly a more difficult task, but hey.
Right. Okay, Lost Frag asks, how'd you end up as part of the Wayward crew? Wayward is an Image Comics publication,
oh, yeah.
In case people didn't know.
That was awesome. That was totally, like, I love American comics, too, and I always wanted to work on an American comic. So that just worked out where, because I go to American comics, and, like, I have quite a few American comic book artists and writer friends and everything like that, and, you know, and I do a lot of work on American comics that's not really visible. Like, I do sort of background Japanese work for people that want to put Japanese in their comics. So my friend Brandon Seffert, who does the comic Witch Doctor, which is also a great folklore comic, was talking to Jim Zub, who had decided to sort of launch this Japanese-based, you know, comic for Image, and he put us in touch with each other. So yeah, that's right. Sort of how that all worked out.
And is that project is over, ongoing?
Nope, still going. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, still right. Very, very much alive. Yeah, I love, you know, I mean, it's been super successful, and it's been a lot of fun too, because, you know, Wayward is like this yokai based comic that's set in Japan, and the artist is there, and like, you know, everyone, I wish that people didn't feel such a need to be in one camp or the other. You know, it's like, oh, I like manga and I don't like comics, or I like comics but I don't like manga. And as someone who has a foot in both worlds, you know, I wish people just liked good comics instead of worrying what country they came from.
I feel like the people who just embrace it and say, I just like good comics, those are the people who wind up really working in the industry and, like, you know, making that industry move forward. Like, those are the people who trailblaze.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. You know, I mean, you know, like I said, I think that you'll find a lot of comic artists, like a lot of American comics, love comic artists, love manga, and love manga star artists.
Yeah, yeah. None of the people who actually work on this shit give a shit about the same things that the fans do.
Exactly. And that's true in Japan, too. Like, every year for the past couple of years, I do this great festival at this college where Yoshimi Kurata, who's another manga artist that's not very well known over here, but he's quite prestigious. He's not only is a manga artist, but he's a professor of manga at a university over there. And he comes over here and basically does these great speeches where he disillusions everyone in the audience, because he talks about, you know, manga artists, we don't care about, you know, all these different categories. You know, like, I hear people, it's like, you know, is this, you know, Jose, is this shonen, blah, blah, blah. He's like, manga artists don't care about that. They're trying to tell stories, you know. That's marketing.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Okay, Lost Frag asks, Yure was great. Any plans for another book?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I've actually got two books that I'm working on right now, but writing books is an arduous process, so I can't tell too much about them. Hopefully things will come. I mean, it took me years to write Yure, probably like 8 years, so, you know, it's a lot of work, but definitely, I'm definitely going to put out some more books. Yeah.
Cool.
Hopefully they won't take me 8 years. I mean, that was my first book, so it was the process of learning how to write a book is involved as well as writing the book itself. And the other ones hopefully will be faster, but they're not really announced yet, so I can't tell what they are.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. All right. Sebro23 asks, any tricks you need to take to jump between really different work like Kitaro and Showa?
I don't know about tricks, but like I said, you know, I mean, for me, a lot of it is just a matter of finding that sort of like the emotional hook to it, you know, and finding the beat and intention of the author. And what I really do, and I went out, did this, talked about this in Confessions of a Manga Translator article, is when I first start translating a comic, like, I don't reread it, but I just sort of read it and I let myself be emotionally impacted by whatever the story is, you know. And so if the story makes me sad or if it just makes me laugh or something, I try really to allow myself to have that. And then my job as a translator is to try and figure out how to make that same reaction to someone in English.
Groovin asks, I'm a huge fan of your site, Hyako Monogatari Kaidankai. Yep, I said it right. All right. Wondering if you have any...
Good job.
Hey, man, I took 4 years of Japanese in college, man. That was only 10 years ago, and I got C's the whole time. But I can kind of pronounce things.
Nice. I'm so used to, like, I made that site when I was doing my master's degree as a way to sort of like toss these translations that I'd been working on. And if I had known that it was going to be popular, I would have named it something differently. So I apologize for that.
Well, he wants to know if you're going to publish more rare yokai stories.
I mean, I would love to, but the only sad thing is that the more successful I've been in my actual career, the less time I have for my hobbies.
Yeah, of course.
And that is just the truth. So I would love to, and someday I hope to carve out a little bit more time to do it. But for the time being, I'm super swamped with actual work, and so I just haven't had any time to do stuff for the blog.
Gotta make money.
Yeah, I gotta make money. So, you know, if people want more, buy my books.
Yep, gotta get paid.
Yep. Gotta get paid.
All right. Aside from Kitaro, any anime, manga, or books that are yokai inspired that you would recommend? What are your favorites?
That are yokai inspired. You know, I'm trying to think of stuff that's yokai inspired specifically. Like, there's a lot that I really love that it's useless for me to say because they've never gotten English translations. Like, I really love Kappa no Kaikata, which is how to raise your kappa. That's another little oddball that I would love to do in English someday. Of them, like, recent ones, gosh, what is there? You know, I tried reading, what's it called in English? The Nura Clan one. And I just didn't love it that much. It was okay. Yeah. Not really, unfortunately. I wish I had better answers for that one.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You gave it a shot?
I did, yeah, yeah.
You tried your best.
Tried my best.
That's all anyone can ask. All right. That actually wraps us up. People can find you. They should look up Kitaro on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold, as well as Showa. The great stuff. I really personally recommend this shit. It's really good. It's really worth reading. Zach's translations are great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Zach. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Zach for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play Music, or Stitcher. Leave us a comment, rating, or review. We'd appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.